It's not an option. It's a right. Cocked, locked, and ready to rock the world of the anti-gunners. You're listening to the guy who had to register his mouth as a full auto weapon. Bill Carnes and 2A Radio. The fight for your rights isn't for pansies. So buckle up for the ride and knuckle down with Bill Carnes and 2A Radio.
Welcome to the show, all you gun lovers out there, and welcome to the show, those of you who are gun haters and are just tuning into the Second Amendment radio show here to hear what's going on the other side. Oh yeah, let's find out what's going on over there with the pro-gunners. You know, we want to know what this crazy man Bill Carnes is talking about when it comes to pro-guns, and see if we can actually defeat the logic and information with our own BS and rhetoric. Well, I hope you have your pens and pencils out for you anti-gunners, because today's going to be a busy show. Let's start off. Yesterday we ended the show talking about how Congress is going to look to take control the unconstitutional government of Washington, D.C. and put them on their fat behinds with constitutional legislation that says, we're not going to allow you to subvert the rights of the people and overly charge them for exercising their rights to be able to have a gun. The Supreme Court already ruled on it. You've done really very little to abide by that court ruling, so we're going to force you into it. Well, one Washington is telling the others a tale about crime statistics. A spokeswoman for the Seattle, Washington Police Department said a couple of days ago that the city posted only 19 homicides in all of 2010, the lowest figure in recent memory, while Washington, D.C., a city with a similar-sized population, logged 131 homicides, according to the Metropolitan D.C. Police Department's website. Now, let's take all of these numbers into account. Seattle, 19 homicides. That's what, like one every 3 weeks? And then you have 131 in D.C., about one every 3 days. A far cry lower, however, in D.C. than their high in the 430 marks of just a few years ago. This column was checked by that department's website after speaking with the Seattle Police Department spokeswoman Renee Witt. Now, that's not bad news for the district. However, because for the second year in a row, the number of murders in the nation's capital declined from 143 in 2009 and 186 in 2008. Prior to that, the number had hovered around 150 and usually above 200 for several years. Several years were before that, they were up into the 400 mark. Now, surprise, surprise, that sharp drop came in the 2 years following the landmark Supreme Court ruling in D.C. versus Heller, which struck down the district's handgun ban and affirmed that the Second Amendment protects an individual's rights to keep and bear arms. Here's something else. Of the 143 murders in 2008, 141 were committed with firearms. Of the 131 killings in 2009, the number of gun-related slayings dropped to 109. So all but two murders in 2008 were with a gun. Now, some of you anti-gunners out there think, oh, I'm frothing now, but then it dropped 2009 to 109. Now, keep in mind that in 2008, the Heller decision came out in late June, like June 25th, 2008. But the city didn't actually react to even allowing any sort of provisions for citizens to have guns until after the first of that next year. Now, the press gives credit for the homicide decline to Mayor Adrian Fentley's administration, which makes sense since Beltway reporters would never suggest that the decline in murders just might be at least partly due to the fact that district residents can now, and do in some cases, legally arm themselves. They appear to be doing that at surprising rates, especially in more affluent parts of the city, which came as a shock, of course, to the Washington Post. In a story last Tuesday, the Post published a zip code map of the district showing where the highest number of newly registered firearms are reported. It may have surprised the Post, but it's not this column, that the gun registrations are not nearly as high in the higher crime, less affluent districts. Is it a matter of economics and the possibility... it is a matter of economics and the possibility that more people living in those areas have disqualifying criminal records. They still have guns, they just don't have them legally. Imagine that. Someone's going to put the grab on a gun and not go through the legal hula hoops that the city puts in place? Wow. It costs $60 just to get a permit and register a handgun in the city today. Then there's the expense of getting it to and from the police department and complete the registration process. The process the department does everything it can to discourage having a gun. Affluent people can afford it. The poor people cannot. Today's revelation presents an interesting dilemma for the gun prohibition lobby, which strenuously opposed the Heller decision and has been working in D.C. in the other Washington to make the other gun laws in the state of Washington more like the gun laws in the city of Washington. With more people buying and registering firearms in the district, the homicide rates have fallen. Compared to Washington, D.C., Seattle's murder rate is almost non-existent, about 6% of the district murders. Yet, in Washington State, including Seattle, much to the chagrin of Mayor Mike McGinn, the folks at Washington Ceasefire, those citizens who can, according to the folks at Citizens Washington Ceasefire, citizens can carry handguns concealed with a license and openly without one. There are lots more guns. There are no more registration, and buying a handgun does not require a lengthy process in the state of Washington. Anti-gunners will predictably argue that there's no correlation whatsoever between high gun ownership and lower crime rates. However, they have been reluctant to predict increases in mayhem with increases in gun ownership. So, their argument doesn't really wash. All you have to do, guys, is own guns and let people know. You know, me and these guys and those guys and the rest of these folks around here own guns and we carry them. And you know something? We know how to use them. And bad guys don't want to turn those people into victims. So the sheer number of people who are would-be victims drop. When there's less would-be victims, there's less crime. And it's not just the murder rates. It's robbery, aggravated assault, all kinds of things, rape, you name it, they go down. Stay tuned, more to come after the break. We'll be right back.
Tell everyone in the room to pipe down. Two-way radio with Bill Carnes is back.
Welcome back from the break, everyone. Well, concealed carry is allowed in one form or another. I should even say allowed. It's honored in one form or another in 48 of the 50 states. Concealed carry. The two that are not are Wisconsin and Illinois, neighbors. Illinois is the only state in the union that doesn't provide any sort of gun carry, handgun carry whatsoever. Completely abuses the rights. You cannot carry a gun anywhere in the state of Illinois. Generally, not because of anybody in western or southern Illinois, but it's because of the folks from Chicago that so heavily dominate the representation in the state house and the state senate. So, every year, stronger and stronger support comes to introducing concealed carry in Illinois. Just last year, a number of sheriffs from the southern part of the state and the western part of the state said, you know, if nothing else, we should try concealed carry as a test bed. If you guys up in Chicago don't want it, fine. Exempt yourself from the law, but allow us to have it because we know through history repeating itself time and time and time and time and time and time again that the more armed citizens that are in a community, the lower the violent crime rate and the lower crime rates all around. So, soon, the folks from Illinois might be able to carry concealed. State Representative Pat Verschuesser said passing a bill to allow concealed carry permits in Illinois may be a long shot, but he said it's your Second Amendment right to carry a gun. Actually, all I did was reiterate Justice Scalia's opinion, the majority opinion in Heller, and right there in the home state of Illinois, the McDonald case, that carrying a gun is a recognized fundamental right that, as the Second Amendment says, shall not be infringed. Vandersheuer said once Wisconsin's governor signs a similar bill, Illinois will become the last state without some form of concealed carry law. He says, my emails, phone calls, personal contacts have been running, I would say 3-1 in favor of concealed carry, according to this representative, Vandersheuer. Vandersheuer said state legislators have failed to pass a law for years, mostly because of Chicago's strict rules on handguns. He said most people committing crimes with guns don't get them legally anyway, and the rest of the state shouldn't have to suffer. He says this law is tight enough that we've told the FOID, which is the Firearm Owner Identification Card, for years, where you have to have a FOID card to even get a gun, and that's even a hard situation to do. In Illinois, you have to go to the police department and get a Firearm Owner's Identification Card. You must own and possess a valid Firearm Owner's Identification Card before you can go buy a gun. Really? Do you have to get a religious practice identification card before you can go practice your religion? And must you keep it in your possession each and every time that you go to practice any sort of religious act? Of course not. They're only subverting and charging for Second Amendment rights. Vandersheuer says, he said sheriff's departments would be in charge of issuing permits based on a strict set of rules, including an age limit of 21 and older, with no criminal record, and a training course to show proficiency with a gun. One gun shop manager in Moline said said it's a law that's long overdue. He says, in the Quad Cities, we have a lot of Iowa customers that come over and have a concealed carry permit, and I have had a few of them in the past forget they crossed the border, said Shooting Sports Unlimited General Manager Stephen Bartels. But not everyone agrees. Some folks say they're worried about guns. The guns will still get into the wrong hands if the bill passes. What if someone has road rage? You know, what people could get shot. I mean, it's definitely a touchy situation, says a concerned parent, December Martin. Okay. What if people, you know, we could sit and what if everything? What if, what if the guns actually get up and start shooting on their own? What if somebody drops a gun as they're going down stairs and it tumbles ass over tea kettle and starts firing on its own and people get shot? What if? Take your what ifs and flush them. I'm so sick and tired of the what ifs. I have to tell you, as a firearms trainer, I have had so many students come up to me with what ifs. Like, when is it legal to shoot somebody? Actually, I like it when it's posed differently. When can I shoot somebody? And my standard response is, whenever you want to. You just got to suffer the consequences. Now, if your question is, when am I legally justified in defending myself in a manner in which a bad guy gets shot, here's kind of the universal response. If the bad guy has motive, intent, opportunity, and you are experiencing from them an imminent threat of death or serious bodily injury to yourself or anybody else in your immediate area, universally, that is the accepted situation to when you have legal justification to pull out your gun and shoot to stop them. Okay? Well, with that being said, I get what if all the time. What if the guy was doing this and I'm out in the parking lot, we're doing that? Are you actually sitting here and planning out your potential attack? We don't have time to sit here and what if, because one what if leads to a whole nother set of what ifs. It's like growing a huge tree. It starts with one little splinter coming out of the ground. Then it begins to branch off, and those branches have branches, and those branches have branches, and those branches have branches, all still stemming from the same trunk. You can't what if everything. And everybody's what ifing. What if this? What if Illinois had some really horrible crime rates in the major city of Chicago? Well, as a matter of fact, they do. They have terrible violent crime rates. What if that was because they had serious gun control in the city in violation of, count them, two recent Supreme Court decisions? Ooh, well, you know what they do? They do. So those what-ifs are real. Okay, yeah, they have high crime rates and they're in violation of two recent Supreme Court decisions dealing with firearms. Okay, what else? What if they actually stopped violating the constitutional rights of the residents of, well, Chicago and Oak Park, an outlying little town there next to Chicago? What if they actually gave up those restrictions and allowed people to exercise their constitutional rights without government interference? If that happened, what if the crime rate went down? Then what? They're trying to say you can't unring a bell. That's not true. Because people in Chicago used to be able to have guns until they passed the horrendous gun control back in 1984. And crime rates skyrocketed. What if they followed the Constitution and the opinions of the Supreme Court in both the Heller and McDonald decisions, striking down Chicago gun law and McDonald, and allowed people to exercise their rights? Then the cops wouldn't be so busy, the criminals would find other things to do, and people could actually enjoy life in Chicago without the fear of being a victim of a violent crime. What if? Stay tuned, guys. There's more to come right after the break. I'm your host, Bill Carnes. You're tuned in right here to 2A Radio.
Attention, all long-range precision riflemen and long-distance shooting hunters. Come and join other like-minded long-range riflemen this April for the Bill Carnes 2A Radio Precision Rifle Course being held just outside Las Vegas, Nevada. This is your chance to put your gear to the test and perfect your long-range rifle shooting skills. Think of it as Sniper 101. We'll be collecting repeatable data from 100 yards out to 1,000 yards and beyond. Imagine having confirmed repeatable data for your rifle and the round you choose in 50-yard increments out to the furthest limit of your trajectories. You'll learn the secrets of the proper way to clean and maintain your precision rifle for extended life and accuracy well beyond your expectations. You'll also have the opportunity to shoot a 50-caliber sniper rifle and hit a target at 1 mile. To find out more, go to victoryshoot.org. Don't miss out on this opportunity. Visit victoryshoot.org today. That's victoryshoot.org.
You're listening to a guy who packs a gun to shoot the bad guys and packs a mic to shoot his mouth off. Bill Carnes and 2A Radio are back.
And welcome back from the break, everyone. We've been talking about concealed carry in Illinois in the last segment, and we talked about the crime rate differences between the state of Washington, where there's no issues with carrying guns, and the city of Washington, D.C., where there's huge restrictions. There's only about 1,400 or 1,500 people that have gone through the long and expensive process of registering guns for the city of Washington, D.C. Crime rates already dropping. Now, in southern Ohio, a home invasion victim defended their own life with a firearm, and the Castle Doctrine offers even further protections. Another crime victim in Ohio has been protected from unwarranted legal expense and even protection, even prosecution, thanks to Ohio's Castle Doctrine law. Pike County Sheriff Richard Henderson told the media that a property owner in Bainbridge interrupted a home invasion in progress just this past Monday morning, a week ago, from the Highland County Press, quote, two male subjects entered a home and held the homeowner at gunpoint when he came in. They were stealing his stuff, and once they left, as they were leaving the premises, the homeowner found a gun, came out onto the front porch. One of the suspects pointed a gun back at him, and the homeowner proceeded to shoot at them. He ended up killing one of the suspects. Henderson said the second suspect fled on foot to a nearby vehicle and left the scene. The Pike County Sheriff's Office is still looking for that suspect. Here's a quote from the Pike County Sheriff. He says, "We don't believe the second suspect to be in the vicinity. We are asking if anyone does know information to contact the Pike County Sheriff's Office or Crime Stoppers." According to a report by Columbus NBC affiliate, the homeowner is not expected to face any charges. I would hope not. He's a victim. A Pike County homeowner's decision to shoot a suspected home invader appears to follow Ohio law, according to Pike County Prosecutor Rob Junk. It's kind of a cool name, Rob Junk. Junk said he considered the shooting justifiable homicide under Ohio law, which allows homeowners to defend themselves if threatened on their own property, not just in the confines of the walls of their home, excluding, like in the city of Chicago, your yard or your garage. Let's see, the suspect later died of his injuries. Pike County Sheriff Richard Henderson has not released the name of the suspect, and a second suspect fled, blah, blah, blah. Okay, we already got that. The home invasion and subsequent shooting on Morgan's Fort Road in Bainbridge happened last Monday night, a week ago. The homeowner's family declined to comment on the case, but confirmed details previously released by Sheriff Henderson. Under Ohio's Castle Doctrine law, if someone unlawfully enters an occupied home or temporary habitation or occupied car, citizens have an initial presumption that they may act in self-defense and will not be second-guessed by the state. So Prosecutor Rob Junk has it right. He'd be the one bringing charges. And he says, no, it doesn't work like that. I'm not bringing these charges. If you were in Washington, D.C., or in Chicago, or any other anti-gun cities around the country, say New York, and these guys busted in and you used a gun, what would happen to you? Well, you'd probably get arrested. Yep, probably get prosecuted. However, in Chicago this last summer, twice in 3 weeks, homeowners who had handguns that didn't possess them legally use their handguns to shoot and stop home invaders. They weren't prosecuted. Their guns were taken away, but they weren't prosecuted. Why weren't they prosecuted? Well, because the law was intended to keep the hands out of bad guys, not good guys. Yeah, the city ordinance was intended to keep the guns out of the hands of bad guys. So if good guys have the guns, even though it's illegal, you can't very well prosecute somebody who used a gun for the intention of a gun. They only want to prosecute people who are breaking law. So what they do is they punish everyone. But those who decide to not follow the unconstitutional law, another reason why you don't see police enforcing these sorts of things, prosecutors prosecuting these sorts of things. If someone has a gun, they're legal to own a gun. But the town or city or state or whatever says you can't do it. because there is such a huge constitutional argument against it, the Supreme Court's already ruled on it, most people don't ever even get arrested or prosecuted for it. However, most of the time they'll still take your gun and make it nearly impossible to get back. A federal agency, switching gears, is now banning lead ammunition for the depredation hunting of birds, citing the need to prevent lead toxicity hazards from wildlife. The federal government's primary wildlife management agency, U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, has banned the use of lead ammunition for hunting nuisance birds. The decision was published by Fish and Wildlife Service as a final rulemaking action to the Federal Register. Keep in mind, this wasn't a law. This is an administrative organization who is making a rule and publishing it in the Federal Register, which now has the full force and effect of law. The American Bird Conservancy, the nation's leading bird conservation organization, expressed support for the decision in a letter sent to the Fish and Wildlife Acting Director, Rowan W. Gould. Depreciation orders are issued by FWS, Fish and Wildlife Service, to allow the killing of migratory birds such as crows, grackles, and blackbirds, which are causing damage to public or private property, and pose a health or safety hazard, or damaging agricultural crops or wildlife. This new regulation will require the use of non-toxic ammunition in the control of these nuisance birds. Quote, we're very supportive of FWS in citing the wildlife of this issue. Depredation hunting tends to leave large amounts of highly toxic lead ammunition on the ground that non-target birds and other wildlife consume while mistaking it for food. These birds or other wildlife will either die agonizing deaths shortly thereafter or suffer severe illness, for a prolonged period. We've had many discussions with FWS about using non-toxic shot for all agency operations, and we are very glad to have made this that they have made this decision. According to Dr. Michael Fry, one of the world's leading avian toxicologists and directors of the conservation agency for ABC. ABC has been one of the leaders in a group that has had petitioned the Environmental Protection Agency on August 3rd, 2010 to ban lead ammunition use for hunting and lead fishing gear because of the toxic threats they pose to wildlife. Guys, lead is naturally occurring in the ground. Where do you think it comes from? We don't create it in a lab, we mine it. Well, the EPA responded that they did not have the authority to regulate lead ammunition, though congressional legislative history records documents that they did have such authority. EPA then later denied the fish gear partition of the petition, saying that evidence of impacts from fishing gear were being addressed by some states and national regulations would be overly burdensome. Wow, that was actually a prudent decision. In the original petition, ABC and other petitioners presented almost 500 scientific studies that documented widespread lead impacts to wildlife that resulted in the lead poisoning deaths of up to millions of birds each year in the U.S. For every junk science study that you can produce, somebody else can produce the exact same number coming to the opposite conclusion. Scientific papers and studies mean nothing unless you pay them to mean something. Stay tuned. We'll be right back.
If you live in a state which allows Class 3 NFA firearms and accessories, and you either have an interest in or already own Class 3 NFA items, the process for an individual to own these items includes photographs, fingerprints, obtaining a letter of permission from your police chief or sheriff, and a full personal background check which is spread across the whole federal system. Until now, Forming an NFA trust eliminates the requirements of letters of permission and all personal data and background checks in purchasing and possessing NFA firearms and accessories. NFA trusts offer a level of anonymity as well as flexibility in the purchasing, possessing, and storage of your Class 3 NFA firearms and accessories. To learn more about forming a secure and flexible NFA trust at a fraction of the cost from attorneys, visit www.billcarnes.com and click on the NFA tab. That's BILLCARNS.com and click on the NFA tab.
As long as politicians attack our rights, Bill will be fighting for them. Two-Way Radio with Bill Carnes is back.
Back on, we'll take you on. Headstrong to take on anyone. I know that you are wrong, and this is not where you belong.
Welcome back from the break. Now, I have said before that if you ever have a government official or a politician or anybody like that standing up, having any sort of a press conference or speaking to a group, speaking in public, there is one telltale sign that they're lying. They're not giving you the whole truth. They're not telling you all of the reasons behind something. And they're lying to all of us. It's a public forum to lie. There's one telltale sign that you know that that's happening. They're speaking. You can't trust anybody. You just can't do it. With, I don't know, maybe you could count on one hand the number of exceptions, and that's all elected public officials, all hired public officials, all department heads, all cabinet members. You could probably count on one hand the number of people who will actually give you the skinny. And they're not going to last long, most likely. It is a bunch of trout in a sea full of sharks that are very hungry. Well, here's a little piece that I'm going to read to you entitled Why No One Should Ever Trust the ATF. That is, there is no Iron River. The Iron River is allegedly all of the thousands of guns that the ATF has alleged are being bought in America and run across the border down south into Mexico to fuel all of the gun violence by the Mexican drug cartels. They're calling it the Iron River. It doesn't exist. We've talked about it many times. Now I'm going to read to you somebody else's opinion on this. They say, I'm not sure what bright spark at the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives, and really big fires, came up with the term Iron River. Maybe it was a journalist, and the ATF simply glommed onto the term. But it's an excellent moniker, an easy-to-remember nickname for a trade of no God-fearing, tax-paying, freedom-loving American would support. Who wants thousands of highly deadly assault rifles flowing from the U.S. to Mexico into the hands of ruthless criminals? Nobody. Except maybe evil gun dealers and suspicious gun makers. So, who are you going to call? The ATF. Truth be told, the Iron River was an immediate hit. Not so coincidentally, the ATF picked up a metaphor and ran with it. Since early last year, the agency's press releases have constantly made mention of the so-called Iron River. Although it branding, sloganeering, and it's a big lie, say something often enough and people begin to believe it, no matter how big the lie. Joseph Goebbels said that if the federal agency charged with policing American gun sales keeps talking about an Iron River of illegal gun sales, if the media repeats the menacing meme like a well-meaning mantra, an Iron River there must be. Not a trickle, mind you, a river. A steady flow of weapons moving from Bob's gun stores or whatever to Los Zetas drug cartel or another. A river that must be damned. Because we're damned if we don't. Damned by a personage of less prominent than Felipe Calderon, the chief Mexican and president of Mexico, damned, chilled, and publicly humiliated for our inability to staunch the flow of the Iron River. Never mind the enormous flow of drugs from Mexico into the U.S., or the most important fuel for the period upon the tens of thousands of Mexicans who have been tortured, raped, and killed and discarded. Those are billions of Yankee dollars. Nope. Once again, Americans were subject to the gun control advocates' favorite and most effective trick, misdirection, a.k.a. blatant lies. The guns, the guns. That's how we stopped the killing. We stopped the guns. The ATF promoted and exploited the idea, lining up in front of Congress, begging bowl in hand, singing, "Take me to the river." And they scored. Four new field offices, dozens of new agents. After spending decades in stasis, watching the FBI double in size, and a whole new federal law enforcement agencies arise from the ashes of 9/11, Uncle Sam, the dysfunctional family member, wrote a check to the ATF. The deeply unloved agency finally had its day in the sun. Only Project Gunrunner was built on a complete lie. As many good marketers will tell you, all brands start with the product. A brand is nothing more than a promise. Coca-Cola will refresh you. Lexus will cassette you in luxury. Smith & Wesson will protect you. The more deeply and completely the brand's product fulfills that promise, the stronger the brand. The Iron River brand was built on a promise that the ATF would nab the bad guys, just like Elliot Ness did. Only there were no bad guys. No cigar-chomping, gun-smuggling kingpins against which the ATF could send its SRT team. In fact, there was no Iron River of guns, period. The ATF sold the idea to Congress, the public, and let's face it, to themselves, based on firearms traces from the Mexican authorities. The ATF claimed that 90% of the guns seized from Mexican drug cartels by Mexican law enforcement officers in 2008 came from the U.S. Right from the get-go, there was plenty of evidence that the ATF's Iron River brand was nothing more than smoke and mirrors. Here's the analyst from Stratfor.com, posted in July, before the ATF got its wicked way with your tax money. According to the Government Accounting Office, a GAO report, based on data provided by the ATF, some 30,000 firearms were seized from criminals by Mexican officials in 2008. Of these 30,000 firearms, information pertaining to 7,200 of them, 24%, were submitted to the U.S. Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms and Explosives, ATF, for tracing. Of these 7,200 guns, only about 4,000 could be traced by the ATF. And of these 4,000, some 3,480 were shown to have come from the U.S. That's 87% of the 4,000. This means that 87% figure comes from the number of weapons submitted by the Mexican government to the ATF that could be successfully traced by ATF and not from the total number of weapons seized by the Mexicans or even from the total number of weapons submitted to the ATF for tracing. 3,480 guns positively traced to the U.S. equals less than 12% of the total arms seized in 2008 and less than 48% of all those submitted by the government, by the Mexican government to the ATF for tracing. It's not 80 to 90%. It's not 87% of all the guns. It's less than 12%. And of those 12%, most of them come through the brokering of the sales of firearms to the United States Department of State. The U.S. State Department brokers these deals. They authorize them. They get the end user certificates. They negotiate the terms. They don't even negotiate terms. They say, here's the terms. If you want them, sign on the bottom line, you'll get your stuff. Another crucial fact that somehow misses the cut. The average American sourced gun traced by the ATF on behalf of Mexicans was 14 years old. That's the average age. What are the odds that the drug cartels awash in cases are going to deploy 20-year-old American weapons with their blood-soaked wars against the federales and each other? In fact, where was the where was the list of confiscated weapons? The veil of secrecy surrounding the stats spoke volumes about the integrity of the ATS branding exercise. So we don't have an Iron River, guys. The average gun traced was 14 years old, so they're not flowing with new guns. Anyone with even a passing knowledge of product can spot a fake brand easily enough. A fake Rolex doesn't look like a real Rolex. A fake Iron River doesn't look like a real gun smuggling epidemic either. Stratfor revisited the Mexican gun smuggling issue just a couple of days ago using the term myth to describe the trade that the ATF swears up, down, and sideways is still a scourge. Well, as it's been reported, a sampling of gun confiscations by the U.S. Customs and Border Protection Agency indicates that the Iron River is nothing but a trickle, even if that. If it's government and it's talking, folks, it's deceiving and lying. Don't ever forget that.
I'd like to close by saying, to those of you within our government, we will be watching you. Congress, the executive, and judicial branches all very closely as we organize to save our freedom, liberty, and country. We will not become the subjects of governmental rule.
Thanks for tuning in. Bill will be back tomorrow. Now go side in and shoot straight. The 2A Radio Show with Bill Carnes. Learn more about Bill at BillCarnes.com. Send your comments to Bill at 2aradio.com.